Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 235, Colin F. Barnes, Artificial Evil. Today's episode is sponsored by Reincarnation War by David Bischoff and Saul Garnell.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding. Oh,
man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Hey everybody, thanks for stopping by the show. My name is Timothy C. Ward. I'm excited to share this interview with Colin F. Barnes. He is a UK suspense thriller dark fiction author. He has a series called The Texorcist. First book is called Artificial Evil, and the second book that just came out is called Assembly Code. He is giving a deal for our listeners. Anyone that goes to his website and emails him through the contact page with the subject of free artificial evil, or however you want to do that, something like that, he will email you a free digital copy of his first book in this series, Artificial Evil. And that offer will go through January 1st, 2014. I am going to be doing an Ask Me Anything on Reddit this Wednesday, October 23rd. So that will be in the sub-forum Science Fiction. There will be a link to that in this show, to that sub-forum, and on our website to go directly to that Ask Me Anything. For those that don't know, Reddit is a very cool website where forums are set up based on whatever topic you're interested in, and news articles, book reviews, questions from other users about certain topics, just all kinds of great content. So it's a cool website to go check out. Hopefully I will see some of you there. Looking forward to next week. We got the Coffin Hop web tour from the 24th through the 31st. We've got an interview with Ronald Malfi and Kevin Lucia, some pretty cool indie horror authors. So hopefully we'll see you then. Thanks for listening, folks. Enjoy the show. I'm pleased to have on the line today Colin F. Barnes. How you doing, Colin?
I'm very well, thanks, Tim. How you doing?
I am great. I am very productive today. Just posted a podcast with Kay Kenyon, and it's really pumped me up. So
cool.
So I wanted to get a chance to catch up with you. I saw that the second book in the Texorcist series is being released October 1st. So for our audience who hasn't heard of you or this series, give them a brief introduction of who you are, and we'll get into it.
Okay. I'm Colin F. Barnes. I'm a science fiction and kind of adventure slash horror writer from the UK. The Texorcist is kind of a blending. Well, it originally started out as a blending of horror and science fiction. But as the series has progressed, it's gone more into the sort of post-apocalyptic science fiction field. Texorcist is going to be a series, three novels long, possibly longer, depending if people want to know a little bit more after the third book. It features two or three main characters. They're hackers mostly, slightly different skills. And they're basically trying to just get by in a really grim post-apocalyptic world. Technology is kind of fractured. It's kind of gone back in time because pretty much the entire world has been wiped out. So they're trying to make do with things they can find. But then on the other hand, you've got a dystopian element where there's a domed city run by a company, and they're basically using it as a science lab. So within the dome, everything's peachy. You know, life's great. Everything is, you know, provided for. at the expense of free will and freedom. So this is the clash of those two worlds, really, that I explore over the three books.
Introduce us to the main character.
Okay, it's kind of three main characters, and that's mostly what the three books are. Each one kind of focuses on a different one, but the central character, which runs all the way all through it, who is the actual Texasist, is a chap called Jerry Cardle, and he's very much an everyman. He's just a guy who is living in City Earth, which is the Dome City. That's all he's ever known. He hasn't known about what happens outside. He's just grown up. He's a technological algorithm designer. And he was actually working with the Death Lottery, you know, to make sure that the population stays under control. They have a Death Lottery there. And it's his job to design an algorithm, you know, to make sure it's fair and whatnot, and, you know, to combat any issues. And he has an awakening in the first book, which is Artificial Evil. And he starts to see a little bit more of what happens on the outside of the dome, and he realizes there's a whole world out there. And of course, his whole entire life, he realizes a liar, and he then has to learn, you know, what the truth is, and that's not always very easy. So that's the main character. And so there's two other characters. You've got Gabe or Gabriel. He's a hacker, and his accomplice or assistant, a girl called Petal. It's a slight mystery around her, which I'll get into in the second book. And those two are kind of, how to explain it, they're like the wardrobe in the Narnia sense. They kind of grab Jerry and they take him out of his world and show him something completely different. And then as a little sort of trio, it's up to them to try and deal with the various problems that come up.
I became a fan of your work through the short story Dark Metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I really related to in your style, I've read a few of your short stories, is Dark Metaphor the one with the writer who's sort of dying?
I don't really want to give too much away, but essentially, yeah, that's the story.
It's been a few years since I read it, but
anyway,
what I really liked about your style is you present a main character who you really want to succeed in his goals, and he's having a really hard time at it, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess would be the summary. And now that I say that out loud, that sounds like just about every character, but how does that style of yours play into Jerry's quest?
I think there is a very close parallel between them in that the character in Dark Metaphor and Jerry is that they're both everymen or every person. They're just the average guy or woman. I try and do that for most of my characters, mostly because I want readers to be able to relate to them. It's like an antithesis to kind of superhero stories. Like, they're always so powerful, and I just think I like to have smaller stories with real people and just see what kind of issues that they're dealing with. And I think it gives you more, or gives me more scope. You know, if you start off with a kind of an average, everyday type of person and then put them into an extraordinary situation, I think they've got a lot of room for them to grow or not, depending on how the story goes. And that's really kind of what I like doing, you know, just kind of an everyday person. It's mostly influenced by Ray Bradbury. You know, his characters I find are always relatable. And that's really it. That's kind of how I write.
Another aspect of Dark Metaphor was the love story and him sort of failing in his relationship and is torn between his ambition to write and the woman that he loves.
Mm-hmm.
Is there the same type of feel in Artificial Evil in the series?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really thought of it on those lines. There is a romantic arc within the Texasist. And there are obstacles that Jerry has to overcome to deal with that. He doesn't necessarily have to fight, sort of against it, like in Dark Metaphor. You know, he doesn't necessarily have that split decision, but there are issues that he comes up against that make it very, very difficult for him. And it's hard for me to say more without kind of spoiling it, because pretty much the entire climax of the whole series hinges on that decision ultimately that Jerry has to make. So I can't really go too much into that. But yeah, this is a small parallel, basically. It wasn't a conscious one, I don't think.
So if the entire series hinges on that, then maybe the answer would be yes. Cool. Well, I'm excited to see that. I heard you on the Roundtable podcast Dialogues talking about Cyberpunk and the claims that it's dead, the claims that, or the difficulties in writing it being, how do you write about technology that could be obsolete before your book's published? What were your thoughts as far as your influences in cyberpunk, your aspirations for this story, and making sure that the technology was workable enough that any advances didn't ruin the reading experience?
For this one, I completely cheated. Basically, the apocalypse, or I'll call it the cataclysm in the story, effectively takes everyone back to zero, and they've only got the stuff they can find. You know, there's been a massive EMP attack, and stuff's just degraded. You know, over the decades, things are just broken. They don't work anymore. There's hardly anybody alive, so there's not the skill base anymore. There's not the knowledge. So they kind of have to make do with what they've got, and a lot of it is primitive stuff, you know, stuff that isn't affected by EMP, or stuff that happened to have been shielded, or, you know, stuff that's been salvaged. So in terms of the technology, that essence outside of the dome kind of goes back, so I cheat. Within the dome and the family, which is the big baddies throughout the book, their technology is, well, I try to just extrapolate, it's set in 2153, so it's quite advanced, but because of the huge wars they had within leading up in the history of the books, they didn't get so far ahead that we can't imagine it, you know. So again, I suppose a little bit of a cheat in that I've kind of retarded the progress slightly, you know. So whereas you have a normal near future science fiction book, 100 years time, you know, we can't even imagine what we're going to be doing in 100 years. You know, we're going to be so far advanced, it's crazy. So I had to design divine a method to kind of slow that progress down, and that's essentially what I've done with the text assist. In terms of cyberpunk and near future, yeah, if anyone's listened to the Roundtable podcast, I think the general consensus was that you can't predict the future, and so therefore you can only write what we've got now and try and extrapolate as best you can, not to really worry too much about it, because the technology is moving too quickly to predict.
I was chatting with the duo that makes up James S.A. Corey. I think it was Ty Frank who said that William Gibson's virtual reality world has kind of been debunked because people found out that it's easier to type into Google than to enter a virtual reality database, which was heartbreaking to me because that I've sort of created a society like that in the novels that I'm working on. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about your work and this series is it sort of has that virtual reality. I mean, if you look at the cover, which is beautiful, by the way, for Artificial Evil, it has this picture of a person with kind of a computer inside their head. Tell us about that technology and how you work that into the story.
Okay, yeah, it's apart from, there is one scene in Artificial which is proper virtual reality, and I kind of do a parody of it. But in general, the way they work is that they have brain chips, and the chips actually affect the various cortexes and sense areas of the brain. So they can, like when you're chatting to someone, for instance, instead of you typing it onto a keyboard, you just think it. You know, we've already got interfaces like that now. So I just, again, it's just a case of extrapolating. So a lot of it is kind of mind interfaces, and also the devices in their head, they manipulate the optical nerves, so they get a kind of effectively an augmented overlay or a heads-up display through their optical nerves. And that's kind of where I suppose the virtual realityness takes place. It's not virtual in that it's actually in their head and happening, but it's not physical, you know. So that's the way I took that. But yeah, it's difficult. It's, you know, you read the William Gibson stuff, and he did get a lot of kind of things right within his stuff. But I don't know. It's really hard to decide where you want to go. I don't think it should stop anyone. You mentioned about how you've got something similar in yours. I think that's perfectly okay, because with fiction, you've got the whole alternative universe idea. You know, just because you haven't got people typing into Google in your book doesn't mean it's wrong. You know, it's just an alternative universe. So there is a lot of freedom in what we can do still with the whole virtual reality idea and virtual worlds.
Yes, I tried to shrug it off, but hearing him say that was kind of a blow.
Our sponsor for this episode is Reincarnation War,
Starhounds number 5. The space opera ain't over till the fat lady sings. Laura Shemzak isn't fat, and she doesn't sing. What she does is kick butt. Alien, robot, human, this hot blip ship pilot is ready to rumble with anything in the galaxy, even with a sinister planet-killing brain named Harla Zox. But this adventure finds Laura's hot butt in a crack. The crew of the Starbow, stranded in a strange dimension, has only 30 minutes to get their starship into gear, rescue Laura from Zox, surrender to the Federation Star Cruiser sent to destroy them, and stop an all-out interstellar war with the mysterious alien Frenral. For more information on Reincarnation War, Starhounds number 5, go to Amazon.com or HotspurPublishing.com. So the title of the first book, Artificial Evil, plays on a conversation that we had in email a while back about this combination of science with evil with a capital E. I'm curious how you put that into your work, this idea of evil.
Okay, it's going to be quite tricky for me to try and talk about. In Artificial Evil, the first book, the evil essence within that is really the actions of people. And I think ultimately, when we talk about evil, that's what it comes down to, and whether or not there's a force that creates that, or whether it's a human decision to be like that and what drives them. So within that book, I explore really people kind of push to the fringe. You know, so they have to kind of go to extreme situations and extreme behaviors to get what they want. So it's kind of exploring how far people have to be pushed before they start doing evil, as you say, with a capital E. And that's really where I like to view it as. I don't really go into kind of the spirituality side of it. I think other writers could probably do a much better job than I can with that, because I don't have a huge theological knowledge or background on that. So I tend to do it more of a behavioural, sort of a scientific point of view, and what could be considered evil and what isn't. And there's a lot of grey area to explore there as well. So there's a lot of characters in there that you think they're doing evil, but then later on in the story you think, actually, they probably didn't have much choice. So it does leave a lot of questions for the reader to decide, is this character evil or are they just really doing for survival?
So how does the title of Texorcist play into that? It sounds like Exorcist with technology.
Yeah, it basically comes down to the fact that in the first book and other books after, the main enemies are artificial intelligences. They're basically created as weapons, and there's a hint that they may be sentient. Again, I can't go into too much because it'll kind of spoil a few bits, but essentially the main problems that Jerry and his friends have to deal with are these artificial intelligences, which are threatening to take down, the last city and start another war. And that's where the artificial element comes in. And it's just thinking, how far advanced does an artificial intelligence have to be before it can be considered sentient? And if it is it possible, or is it likely something could do evil actions? If something hasn't got a conscience or hasn't got a morality base, does its actions still count as good or evil? So I explore a little bit of that. And again, I do leave a lot to the reader to decide. It's up to them to think, are these artificial intelligences, are they ruled by the person who's controlling them, or do they have choice? And again, Jerry, he kind of asks, doesn't really ask, but he interacts with an artificial intelligence at one point, and there's a conversation that kind of deals with that. So hopefully, I do cover it somehow and give a few of my own thoughts. But again, I like to kind of leave it open. So it'd be interesting if other people read it and see what they think of it.
Tell us a little bit about your marketing campaign for the second book.
Yeah, it's mostly, I'm not really doing a big push on the second book, basically because it's a trilogy, it's a single arc across the three books. So if I try and pimp the second book, no one's read the first one, it's a little bit redundant. So a lot of my efforts are going into getting the first book out there. The problem is I've left it quite long. I published Artificial Evil in November last year, so it's taken a little bit longer than I wanted to get the second one out. So I think everybody's forgotten about Artificial Evil. So what I'm doing is, for the first couple of weeks, I'm dropping that to 99 cents. I've got a whole bunch of adverts coming out between, I think it's the 1st and the 8th of October on a lot of these mailing lists. But I've also got an offer on my own mailing list. If you sign up, I'll give you a free copy of Artificial Evil. And then book two, that'll be out on the 1st of October. So hopefully I can push book one, get that out there, people to look at. And if they like it, they can read it for free or for 99 cents. And then if they like it, then there's the second book there. Maybe when the third book comes out, I'll do a bit more marketing for the second one. But at the moment, it's really just a case of reintroducing people to Artificial Evil and then hopefully get them into the series.
You've been a pretty busy guy. Did I see correctly on Twitter about your goal to write 500,000 words this year?
Oh, it was the million word challenge.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, basically, there's, you know, this 10,000 hours thing. I think it's, is it Maxwell? I can't think of his name.
Gladwell.
Gladwell, I think it is, isn't it? Yeah, he posited that it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert in something. And that's been obviously hotly debated over the years. And I think it was either Stephen King or one of these other horror guys. He mentioned that you need about 1 million words. Actually, it might have been Hemingway. He said you get, you know, write 1 million words to get the rubbish out. Obviously, I've done that quite a few years ago. And I thought, actually, it'd be quite nice now that I'm writing full time, partly to give me a little bit more focus and, you know, just to try and get a lot more content done. So I set up a challenge and a bunch of other writers wanted to do it. So I've done a semi-public spreadsheet, like invited for these ones, and we just all tracked our words. And I think it worked out 2,740 words a day for the whole year. I realised that it was unlikely it would hit the million because things always crop up, you know, either illness or other commitments. But I thought, at least if we stick to it and we try and hit those 2,740 a day, by the end of the year, even if we haven't hit 1 million, we're likely to get pretty close. And I think one of them, I think a lady called Helen, I think she's actually ahead of target. So if she carries on, she'll probably hit the million. Personally, I think at the moment I'm up to 450,000. So I've got two or three more novels which I'm just finishing off at the end of the year, so I'll probably come out around about 600 or 650, something like that. So the goal was to get over 500, but the aim was 1 million.
So how has this year been for you as far as is Anachron Press still going?
Yeah, that's my small publishing house on the side. That's really kind of what I started off with. I started doing anthologies, and then I've done a line of pulp stories called Pulpline. And it's done okay. I think the problem with that is it takes up a huge amount of time, so it doesn't leave a lot of time for me to write, and that's really where my main love is. So for this year, I've kind of put Anachron a little bit on the back burner and concentrated on my own work, but I'll put all my own work out through Anachron. And then hopefully next year I'll have a couple more anthologies and a few other projects coming out. But yeah, it's doing okay. I'm really, like, really happy with the authors that I've worked with. And I think for me, that's one of the really nice things about it. I've made some really good friends with the authors that have contributed to some of the anthologies and the pipeline of stories.
What are some lessons that you've learned or ways that you've improved in your writing this year through writing, 400,000 words?
The main thing, I think, is pattern recognition. I think when you're not writing very often, you don't always see your errors unless you have editors who point that out to you, you know, often. So for instance, this year there's a couple of odd little things I do. I tend to abuse semicolons and ellipses, so, you know, I've learned to take them out. And also just little weird narrative things, you know, there's certain crutch phrases I use too often, certain crutch words I use too often. And sometimes, depending on the sort of pace of the scene, I tend to slip into passive voice. By being so focused and by writing so much, it's enabled me to see these faults a lot earlier on. So now, when I'm writing, I'm a little bit more cognizant of what I'm doing. You know, so mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely giving me focus.
What's your system as far as people looking at your work or editing?
Okay, I have a number of people that I hire out to. I don't edit myself, basically because I like to have as many pairs of eyes on it as I can. I've kind of refined the process over the year. That's the other thing I suppose I've learned this year is to get a process that works for me and the people that I work with. Essentially, the way it works is I'll do the first draft. I'll usually leave it a week or so. I don't like to leave it too long. And then I'll do a second pass through looking for major plot errors. I'll clean it up. Again, I don't go too crazy about cleaning it up at that point because a lot of it could get changed, so it's not really worth it. So once it's in a reasonably good shape, I'll give it to, I've got two or three beta readers who are very kind they'll read it through. And again, I look for sort of common elements. If two or three people say this bit doesn't work, then that's something I'll definitely look at. If I get conflicting reports, then I'll just go with what I feel like in the gut. Once I've changed anything like that, I'll do another draft to clean it up. And obviously, like I was saying before about me crutch phrases and odd things that I know that I do wrong, I clean all those up, and then I send it off to my copy editor, who will then go through, make sure I've done anything silly, and just generally get it up to par, and then it comes back to me for the final proofread before I publish it. In general, say my last book, Assembly Code, I finished, I think it was the 10th draft last Friday, and that was the final proofread pass with putting all the corrections in. So on average, everything I put out is usually between about 7 and 10 drafts.
And the beta readers are looking at it how many times?
Only once.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't like to rely too much on beta readers. It's a case of, one, I don't want to burden their time. Cause I think especially if you're writing full time and you're writing quite a lot, it can put a lot of pressure on people to say, oh, look, I've got 3 or 4 novels this year. I want you to read them all. So I don't like to burden them too much. And also, I think once they've read it once, their opinions then are tainted because they've already got the memory of that first read. So if you do some changes and give it back to them, they're not going to really give you that much more of the information you've already got. And that's why I tend to then like to do the changes, then give it to a copy editor, because the copy editor wouldn't have seen it at that point. So if anything has escaped my eyes and the beta reader's eyes, then the copy editor will catch it. So between 4 or 5 of us, generally it's going to be pretty decent by the time it goes out.
For you, what's the biggest deciding factor between publishing through Anachron and submitting?
Well, there's advantages and disadvantages of both. I like the hybrid approach. I'm not anti-big publisher or anti-traditional publisher. I think they do many things bad, but they also do some good things too. And I think writers these days, you probably should take all varieties available to you, or avenues, I should say, sorry. So for instance, next year I've got a novella coming out with Dark Fuse, who are really up and coming small press in the United States, and they're fantastic. They've been really good. I've really enjoyed working with them. But in terms of self-publishing, it's control. I love being able to control the product. So for instance, I've done all the covers myself. And I went through a couple of iterations with those, but generally within a budget, I can kind of choose any artist I'd like to work with. Whereas I've heard so many horror stories where people will have a cover done with a publisher and they absolutely hate it and you can't get it changed, or, they come up with a ridiculous title. And I think was it Barry Eisler? He had a problem with this with his books, and he's recently just redone all his covers and retitled them, and they've done much better. I think sometimes the author does know better when it comes to titles or covers of their books. So I like to have the control. It's also flexibility. For instance, with the artificial label, it's up to me. I can do the sale. I can say, okay, we're going to do it for 99 cents for a couple of weeks to help promote the second book. A lot of the publishers won't always do marketing plans like that. They tend to put a book out and forget about it. So it's, it's just control. And also the money's better. 70% royalties, it's just so much better than what they're offering now for digital. I think it may be Penguin. They were offering tops of 25% for their digital ebooks. And this was at the time when their formatting was horrible. I think they're a lot better now, but a couple of years ago, some of the formatting that these traditional publishers put out were really bad, and that put a lot of people off of e-reading. Whereas with me, if I see a problem, which there usually isn't, but if I do see a problem, I can fix it within minutes. Whereas sometimes these publishers put out a book and they've got errors in there for months on end because they're just too busy to deal with such little micro issues. So self-publishing, it gives you full control and a better return for your money. But it is very competitive. That's the problem. It's hard to be seen.
I'm not sure if this will be too personal, but I'm just curious how your career is going with writing full-time and kind of what you're hoping to do.
It's slow. It's really hard. People think, they read people like John Locke or Hugh Howey and these guys making megabucks, but the reality is it's very hard to be found. You need a pretty big catalogue. And even with Anachron Press, I think we put out maybe 15 or 20 books. And some do well and others sink without a trace. It's very hard to keep your mind at the top of people's mind and keep within the charts. So you have to constantly put new work out there and pimp your work. But I'm doing enough to pay the rent. I'm getting by. Not eating very much. Pretty much take all the luxuries out. I don't spend hardly anything on luxuries. But I'd much rather be poor and happy doing something that I love than being stuck in a dead-end job like I was before, being absolutely miserable, you know, completely depressed and everything just really not being good at all. So I'm happy to make that sacrifice, and it's a long-term view. You know, the more books you've got out, the better chance you've got having a decent living. At the moment, I'm just about to keep my head above water, and I'm happy with that.
The Artificial Evil, is that going to be 99 cents for the first 2 weeks of October?
Yeah, that's the plan. I might extend it on a little bit. It depends on how the initial promotion goes. But yeah, it's 99 cents. But if people want a free copy, if you go to my blog, I think it's the current blog post. There's a little bit at the bottom. You just sign up to my newsletter and I will send you a free copy of the book in whatever e-format you like, EPUB, Mobi or PDF. So you can get a free copy that way. And all I ask for that is just, you know, just a review if you like it. You know, if you don't like it, give me a bad review as well. You know, I just want honest feedback, really. But if you don't want to do it that way, like I say, it will be available for 99 cents and it'll be going out on mailing lists and blogs and various things for the first week.
Is it released in paper as well?
There is a paperback version, and that's also signed up to the new Amazon Matchbook system. I don't know when that goes live, but when it does, it means that when you buy the print book, you'll get a free ebook as well. And it's the same with Assembly Code, the second book, that's signed up to their Matchbook service as well. It may be live in a month's time. I didn't actually see the date, but I think that's vaguely what I remember them saying. So there's some good deals there. You know, I like paper, so I always do paper versions.
Very good. Well, Colin's website is colinfbarnes.com. He is on Twitter. Is it at Colin F. Barnes?
Yep, that's it.
And Facebook as well?
Yep, I'm on Facebook. I haven't got a page, so my URL for that is some crazy Facebook URL. But if you just type in Colin F. Barnes, you'll find me on there.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for coming on, Colin. Look forward to reading Artificial Evil and getting more of this series.
That's great. Thanks for having me on, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks again to our sponsor, Hotspur Publishing. Their book is Reincarnation War, Starhounds No. 5.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.